Oh, I've been running from the law. Hope they won't shoot me down soon.
I'm Todd McComas.
And I'm Jessica Knoll. And we are
the investigators.
Try to catch me howling at the moon.
Welcome back to all our partners in crime. We hope you had a crime-free week. And if you did not, we hope that everyone is okay and that you have the right investigators on the case.
And if you don't, reach out to us. We've got nothing better to do.
Halloween is a week away. Jessica, do you have the yard all decorated and all your trick-or-treat candy purchased?
You know I do. You know I prepare months in advance. As soon as it hits the shelves, I'm working on it. Inside, outside, it's ready.
We are not ready. We have not bought a single thing yet. We need to get on it. My wife keeps saying, hey, every day, let's go over to Costco. Let's go to Walmart. Let's start loading up. All the neighbors are putting their stuff up. She's getting jealous. But let's talk candy.
You gotta have good Halloween candy. And you got to at least have the candy, Todd. So get that, because otherwise your houses get egged.
We will definitely get candy. But favorite Halloween candy, least favorite Halloween candy, where do you stand?
Okay, well, a lot of people I know, their least favorite are those, like, they're wrapped in a weird wrapper, like orange and black wrappers, and it's like a peanut butter flavor. I actually enjoy those. So I get all those when people, you know, when our kids were going out. But my favorite is Reese's. Anything Reese's. And if you disagree with me, we cannot be friends anymore.
I totally agree. First of all, we are a full-size candy bar family because that's always the favorite house of the neighborhood. So, I want to achieve that status. So I always make sure that we have full-size candy bars. Reese's, definitely the best of all the candy bars, of all the candies that have ever existed. Reese's, in my opinion, is the best. I don't mind those little waxy peanut butter things you're talking about either.
Right?
Like, I know, I realize it's kind of like chewing on a peanut butter candle, but as long as the candle's peanut butter, I'm in, you know?
Right. It's peanut butter.
Yeah. My least favorite, candy corn. Fuck yourself on some candy corn.
Oh, no. But only during Halloween. Like, I won't eat it. You know, any other season when they try to come out with some weird finagly like Christmas version of it. No, it's only going to be Halloween and only a couple. But yeah, no, I'm not a bit. I don't hate candy corn. I do hate licorice, like black licorice.
Oh, really?
Like, don't give me black licorice.
Ugh. I don't mind black licorice. I'm a big fan of Twizzlers. Obviously, anything red licorice or the rope or whatever. Love those. But here's what the candy corn reminds me of. Those hard little pieces, like when you let a cake that has icing on it sit on your counter for like a year, and then just chunks of the icing flake off and fall to the floor. Those hard, crunchy pieces of icing, that's what candy corn reminds me of. Right or wrong, it's where my mind's eye goes, and I just can't do it.
It's like hard pieces of sweet deliciousness, Todd.
I get it. I don't know, but for some reason, I have a mental block. Maybe it's because I grew up surrounded by cornfields. Maybe I'm just against, you know, candifying corn.
Candifying.
It's the Midwest staple, or at least the Indiana staple. I don't know. But yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready for candy. I always buy twice as much candy as I know we're going to need. That way I have it for like 2 or 3 months afterward to dip into myself.
So here's a fun fact. I actually will not buy Reese's to hand out, because then if there's any left over, I'm going to eat it all. So I will buy myself like a couple of the Halloween pumpkin Reese's, because I find the holiday Reese's are the perfect ratio of peanut butter to chocolate. I don't like a regular Reese cup as much. It has to be a holiday version. And I love that they do every holiday something different, but that's what I do. I buy stuff I don't like to hand out, so I don't eat it.
Makes sense. And I've heard that strategy before. I do the opposite because I'm on a race to diabetes. But I agree. Like Reese's, I love a good Reese cup, but somehow the holiday version of the Reese cup is better. Like Easter time, Halloween time, Christmas time, that even the Christmas tree shaped ones are somehow better because they do get that ratio more perfect somehow. I didn't know. I don't even know if I could ever, in good honesty, think I would ever be able to use the word more perfect when it applies to Reese's, but they did it. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing. All right. Enough about everything that's going to kill me years earlier than it should. Everyone grab a shovel because it's time to dig into this week's case. This week is a bit of a departure for us because we're not examining an unsolved case. This case has been adjudicated, but we're covering it for two specific reasons. First, the person responsible for these crimes is a bit of an anomaly as offenders go. Secondly, we have a rare and, dare I say, exclusive access to a person whose specialized field of expertise helped bring this man's reign of terror to an end.
We need to warn you up front, this case is dark, bizarre, and extremely disturbing. And there's no way for us to cover the events surrounding this investigation without discussing things that might be upsetting to some listeners. These crimes are beyond horrendous. So this episode is not for the faint of heart.
Okay, now that you've been warned, let's read you into it. We're headed to the home of some of the most important Revolutionary War battlefields in the southern United States. A place named after a fierce local militia from that era known as the Spartan Regiment. A regiment that really gave the British hell during the fight for our country's independence. Shout out to all our listeners in the UK. No hard feelings, we're on the same team now. Hashtag Team Earth. This case takes place in Spartanburg, South Carolina.
Todd Christopher Kolob is now known as the infamous Amazon Review Killer. He's an American killer who's an exception to the rule because he fits not one, but two major classifications of a killer. Todd Kolob is both a serial killer and a mass murderer. So as killers go, he's a rather unique animal.
A serial killer, by definition, kills three or more people following a predictable behavior pattern with a cooling off period between murders. A mass murderer kills three or more people at one time and in one location. Todd Kolob fits both, which makes him a particularly dangerous and evil creature. But when Cy Ray, former homicide detective and world-renowned expert in cellular device tracking and record analysis, was asked to assist in this investigation, no one knew this evil creature even existed, let alone that he had anything to do with the task at hand.
For, I don't know, probably 6 months after this case, I had people talking about the Amazon Review Killer. I had no idea who it was. Because when I got involved with the case, he wasn't anybody. He wasn't the Amazon Review Killer. Nobody knew who Todd Kolob was. So it was kind of funny because we finally solved the case and everything came out. We found out, hey, this guy's a serial killer. But the whole Amazon Review thing came out way later. So I'd have people be like, hey, you were part of the Amazon Review serial killer. And I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. So it was kind of funny when I first got the case, it had nothing to do with the serial killer. It was just this poor missing girl. And, you know, it's one of those very symbiotic relationships that you have in law enforcement. I had just taught a class out in Anderson, South Carolina. And I think I flew home like Friday night. Sunday, I got a text message from one of the students in class. And he was basically like, hey, caught my first missing person case since your class. Took all 48 hours. This one's kind of weird. Do you mind giving me a call? So I called him up. We chatted real briefly. And I hate to say it, but it was like the run-of-the-mill missing person. Nobody had seen or heard of from Kayla Brown, and her boyfriend was with her. And this detective had just gotten into the missing persons unit. So this was his first case that he caught. He's like, hey, I just need some help, man. Can you help push, you know, some buttons on what direction we need to go? So yeah, my motivation was just, it was a Thursday for us. That kind of call came in all the time.
Unfortunately for Cy and others with his expertise, they're not able to go to work until they're provided the records and the data they need from the officers requesting their help. And although they can offer advice on how to speed that process up, ultimately, they're at those officers' mercy.
My thought, and I push this case all the time now as an example, is this is exigent. And what I mean by exigent is we have a missing person. We don't know the status of that person. Are they dead? Are they kidnapped? You don't know what the hell's going on. And they didn't feel like they could articulate that exigent requirement with the phone company, which I completely disagree. It's just a matter of law enforcement being able to really speak to what they have. And so instead of doing exigency, they decided to run with search warrants. And you're going to see how this goes horribly wrong when we finally figure out what we have. So that initial conversation took place. They decided to use search warrants. We knew what type of devices they had. So we had Kayla's device, obviously, and her boyfriend's identified. So they wrote the search warrants to the phone companies for, you know, anything and everything we could get metadata-wise. And when they come back, he hits me up about 6 weeks later. So, you know, your listeners may hear, like, you got a call for missing persons, and 6 weeks later, you follow up, like, what the hell? But it was really common for us to get phone calls from law enforcement requesting some type of assistance. And a lot of times they would figure the case out. They don't keep us updated. I mean, there's really no need to. So yeah, it was perfectly normal for me to get a call 6 weeks later to be like, hey, remember that missing person? Not really, but kind of, I guess. And he had the records, but he had no idea what he had. It can be super confusing, right? So he sends me the records, and I don't know, I probably got him within about 30 minutes of talking to him. Now we're 6 weeks past Kayla being missing. And I throw them in our software at the time, where it allows us to basically map patterns of mobile devices as they move around and as they stagnate in different places. So, you know, a really good example of this is you drive to work every day, you come home every night. If we load 30 days worth of your cell phone records into our system, you would be able to see that pattern of you going to work every day, the general area where you work, the general area where you come home. At night, that phone stagnates right at your house while you have it plugged in on your little coffee table there, or wherever you plug in your phone in. So in this particular case, we had enough of a time frame. I could see the normal patterns, and I didn't know the exact day Kayla was reported missing. I just didn't have a lot of the case details, but you could see a big deviation from her normal pattern where she kind of drives out in the middle of nowhere. And her boyfriend's phone is also tracking with her. So you can tell they're together, and then it just stagnates and then it just dies.
We'll pick up where we left off with Sai when we get to that climactic point in the timeline. But in order for you to understand how unique a creature Todd Kohlhepp actually is, we need to fill you in on everything that led up to that point.
According to residents in the area, Todd Kohlhepp was known as a friendly, likable guy. Aren't most serial killers next door, though? And by all accounts, a very successful real estate broker in Spartanburg, South Carolina, and owned several properties.
What residents there didn't know, Todd Kohlhepp was a monster. A monster who was already a convicted sex offender in another state. A monster who, after serving his time for that crime, hungered for more.
He was born in Florida in 1971. But raised mostly in South Carolina and Georgia. His parents divorced when he was still a baby, and his mother soon remarried. His father moved to Arizona, and he was constantly at odds with his stepfather. It was a dysfunctional relationship that was disruptive enough to the whole household, so much so, Kohlhepp spent much of his time with his grandfather, who was reportedly very abusive.
His mother and stepfather moved a lot, which made it hard for him to make or keep friends. He displayed a lot of anger as a child and a penchant for torturing animals. His mother became so afraid of him that she installed a lock on the outside of his bedroom door so she could lock him in at night. And as an added safety precaution, she installed a series of deadbolt locks on the inside of her bedroom door. It's like being roommates with Hannibal Lecter.
At least a young Hannibal Lecter. Because this level of security came after a night that his mom allegedly awoke to her son standing at the side of her bed, holding a kitchen knife and staring silently at her. Pretty much the things nightmares are made of, especially if you're a parent.
Yeah, but at the same time, man, I'm one of those people who leans toward the monsters are made, not born theory to serial killer evolution. So part of me wants to say to the mom, what'd you do? You know what I mean? I know it sounds like I'm mom shaming a bit right now, but that's only because I am. But don't worry. Dad's going to get his time soon enough.
Let's go back to at the age of 9. His mother actually had him committed to a psychiatric hospital, and his primary counselor there said that young Kolup was dangerously preoccupied with violence and sex. Pretty bizarre things for a 9-year-old boy to be preoccupied with.
I was born the exact same year as Kolup, and when I was 9, I was preoccupied with baseball and Spider-Man. So I'm guessing the two of us had very different childhoods. And as you said, it's not natural for a 9-year-old boy to be dangerously preoccupied with violence and sex. So what the hell was this guy exposed to at a young age? My guess, violence and sex.
Well, after he's released from the psychiatric hospital, it didn't take long for his mother to throw in the towel and send him to live with his father in Arizona. But no surprise there either. His father wanted nothing to do with him either shortly after his move.
He hadn't been involved in his son's life much up to this point, and he pretty much goes from no kid in his life to full-time caregiver for future Michael Myers. That's the opposite of hitting the lottery. But some of these parents end up making the bed they end up sleeping in. That's what I'm saying.
Well, young Kolup's dad had a lot of problems with his son as a child from this point on. He chose to deal with those problems by leaving him home alone whenever possible. I don't think that's a good remedy for these problems he was experiencing with his son, but nonetheless, that's the remedy he chose. He wasn't about to let this newfound fatherhood slow down his single man's party lifestyle. And young Kolup, listen, his first name's Todd. I know that's a bit weird for you, but I'm just going to say Todd until he gets old enough to just call him Kolup. Cool?
Let's go with Todd K.
Todd K. wasn't digging the situation at his dad's any more than his dad was. So he made several attempts to go back to living with his mom. But she wasn't having that. She wanted nothing to do with him. And by the time he was a teenager, he was a full-fledged psychopath. He would later tell police that when he was 14 years old, he killed a man who had shot one of his friends.
Now, this murder was never confirmed, but at the age of 15, something happened to confirm that Todd K. more than deserved the label psychopath. He had an infatuation for a 14-year-old girl in his neighborhood. And one day he saw her riding her bike, so he approached her and told her that her boyfriend had sent him there to bring her to where he was. But she wasn't buying it. And when she refused to go with him, he pulled a pistol he had taken from his dad's closet and forced her to go to his house where he tied her hands with rope. And once inside, he taped her mouth shut and sexually assaulted her. And after the assault, he walked her home and threatened to kill her younger siblings if she told anyone what had happened. But this 14-year-old girl was strong, man. Strong enough to report what had happened in spite of his threat. And Todd K. was arrested. Ultimately, he confessed to her kidnapping and aggravated sexual assault, but because he was only 15, some extra steps in the process had to occur.
Because of the severity of the crime, the judge was faced with whether or not he should try him as a juvenile or as an adult. So he ordered a psychological evaluation be conducted to help determine that. Psychiatric evaluators determined that Todd K. had a borderline personality disorder and an IQ of 118, which it's considered above average. The judge in this case recognized his intelligence and thought he should be allowed to advance academically. But he also believed that he was so behaviorally and emotionally dangerous, he could not be rehabilitated. So the judge tried him as an adult, and Todd K. pled guilty to the kidnapping charge in exchange for the state dropping the sexual assault charge.
He was sentenced to 15 years in Arizona State Prison, and even though the sexual assault charge was dropped from his plea deal, he was still ordered to register as a sex offender upon his release, which still didn't sit well with the people in the community. They were irate that the state dropped the aggravated sexual assault charge, but I feel like this judge did what he could after that deal was struck. And at least he ensured that Kolup would have to register as a sex offender after his release, which is good in theory.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, at least others are going to be alerted when he moves into their area, right?
Right. Yeah. That's like when the team from the government goes house to house and informs everyone that a convicted sexual predator has moved near them, and they show everyone photos of him and what he's driving and exactly where his house is. All that stuff.
Well, I guess technically most of that is available on the website as long as they report when they move and all that stuff like they're supposed to.
Yeah, I get it. I just think it's a shame that we're not to the point where we're all comfortable with like surgically implanting some type of bell in these people. So whenever they're around, you hear that little bell, you know, like we do cats.
I'd be good with that. Now, while incarcerated, Kolop earned a bachelor's degree in computer science. Remember, he's smart. And he was released in 2001 after serving 14 of his 15-year sentence, which, in my opinion, would suggest to me that he wasn't exactly a model inmate.
Yeah, because with good time, you usually only serve like half your sentence if it's state time. Plus, usually you get a time credit when you achieve certain academic goals. So if he went as far as to graduate college with a bachelor's degree while he's in prison and he still served 14 years, he fucked up enough to cancel out any good time that he had earned.
So after he's released, he moves back to South Carolina, and as ordered by the court, he registers as a sex offender. At least he can follow that rule. In 2002, he gets a job as a graphic designer with a sports apparel company in Spartanburg, South Carolina, called Seven Sons and Company. They make the NCAA-licensed rain ponchos, which is kind of cool. So he works there until November 6, 2003. Which happens to be the very same day that four people are found shot to death inside Superbike Motorsports, a motorcycle dealership just outside Spartanburg.
Hell of a coincidence, eh? Kolop works a few jobs after that, but not staying with any of them for a lengthy period of time. But he does manage to take flying lessons and eventually gets his private pilot's license through the FAA in March of 2006. And he earned a second bachelor's degree in business administration. This dude's motivated. You got to give him that.
He was a busy man, but it doesn't stop there. In May 2006, he applied to take the South Carolina Realtor's exam. By the way, he doesn't disclose to the real estate licensing board that he's a registered sex offender on his application, and they fail to catch it. He does disclose, however, that he was convicted of kidnapping two decades earlier. But he tells them that was a result of a malicious fabrication by his girlfriend at the time and her parents, who didn't want their daughter dating him anymore. And guess what? They believed him.
How the hell does this happen? You just take a convicted kidnapper's word that he didn't really commit kidnapping? You're a licensing agency that licenses people whose job requires them to be in other people's homes. Make a phone call or two. Or better yet, just err on the side of caution. And deny the application.
Right? Like, was South Carolina super hard up for realtors in 2006? Was there a realtor shortage I'm not aware of? Really, I'd like to know this. I need to do some digging.
I'm going to have to Google this.
At any rate, Kolop receives his license. And then he ends up opening his own real estate company called TKA Real Estate, which has 15 employees. Employees that would later report how they were uncomfortable with how he would casually watch porn on his computer while he was in his office, and how he would sexually harass female employees by berating them with sexual innuendo.
Hey, will you broads keep it down? I'm trying to watch this cheerleader have sex with an entire football team over here. That's the premise of Debbie Does Dallas, which is not safe for work, by the way.
Nightmare. But none of this slowed down his business. He was actually pretty successful. And in his first year of operation, he won Rookie Broker of the Year for the state of South Carolina. And that's how things go for quite some time. The real Todd Kolop goes unnoticed and under the radar for the next decade. No one sees him for the monster he really is. Just a likable enough cocky business owner who makes women in the office uncomfortable.
Which was the premise of the TV show Mad Men. But on November 3rd, 2016, that would all change. Todd Kolop's facade would finally crumble as police would make a grisly discovery on his property. Kayla Brown and her boyfriend, 32-year-old Charles Carver, better known as Charlie, had been missing since August 31st of 2016. The couple had just moved in together and needed extra money, so Kayla told Charlie that she could probably get them some work from this real estate broker she had met through an ex-boyfriend. Unfortunately for Kayla and Charlie, that broker was Todd Colep.
Colep gave Kayla a job right away, cleaning his new home listings. Eventually, he told Kayla he had a job for both she and Charlie that would pay them both very well. He said he needed them to clear some brush on his own 95-acre property, and this property was conveniently located about 8 miles away from his home.
So on August 31st, 2016, the couple arrived at the property, and Colep told them to wait outside while he went into the garage to get something for them. Kayla and Charlie were lured to this heavily wooded property out in the middle of nowhere, believing they were there to work. But Colep had different plans.
Okay, right off, I don't like where this is going. And I feel like if this was a horror movie, I'd be yelling at my TV right now to tell them, get out of there.
This is exactly that part of the horror movie where everybody should be yelling, get the hell out of there. Don't go in there, because we all know what's going to happen. But it ends up coming anyway. Days went by. Kayla and Charlie's family and friends grew increasingly worried that something bad had happened to them. Neither were returning texts or calls, and eventually, they were both reported missing.
Family members checked their home and found no sign of travel. In fact, their dog was inside the home with no food and no water. And according to their family, the couple would never allow that to happen. And family and friends were baffled by their disappearance. And unfortunately, at that time, police had no leads to work from. Then, out of nowhere, Charlie, or someone using Charlie's account, posted on Facebook. The user posing as Charlie posted that he and Kayla were expecting a child and that they had just purchased the house together and now they're married. The user got into arguments in the comments section with people asking about Kayla and wanting to hear from her.
And this imposter was not good at playing the role of Facebook Charlie. He wrote weird, out-of-character posts. Posts like, quote, digging holes in the backyard late at night to keep the nosy neighbors guessing. Things like that. This sick asshole was trying to make it look like Charlie had lost his damn mind and had done something terrible to Kayla. And to top things off, the final post was lyrics from the song Hotel California. Quote, last thing I remember, I was running for the door. I had to find the passage back to the place I was before. Relax, said the night man. We are programmed to receive. You can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. What a sick, twisted fuck. Luckily, Charlie was such a good dude, none of his friends or family were buying that this was Charlie.
So they started commenting on these posts with things like, quote, is that what you did with Kayla and the real Charlie? And as it would turn out, Facebook Charlie would be none other than Todd Colep. So what happened that day on August 31st, 2016? Well, when Colep walked back out of the garage and towards Kayla and Charlie, they notice he's carrying a handgun, a Glock semi-automatic handgun.
Before they can react to what they're seeing, Colep raises the gun, points it at Charlie, and fires three shots. All three rounds strike Charlie in the chest. He then grabs Kayla, who's frozen with shock, and he handcuffs her, and he walks her inside a large metal shipping container, otherwise known as a Connex box. And once inside, he chains her by the neck, ankles, and hands to an eye bolt that's bolted to the frame inside the container. And there she remained, alone, imprisoned.
And twice a day, like clockwork, Colep unchains her, takes her to a garage on the property where there's a dirty mattress on the floor, and sexually assaults her. She's fed once a day and given two bottles of water, one to drink and one to clean herself. This was her hell, a hell she'd have to maintain while police searched for her.
They obtained a search warrant to access Kayla's Facebook account. There, they found messages between Kayla and Charlie discussing the job on the Culhepps property on August 31st, the last day they were seen. This fills a crucial gap in the couple's timeline for police. When someone goes missing, the first thing you want to establish is what new thing or things happened in their life right before they went missing. Were they supposed to meet someone? Did they have specific plans to go somewhere? Were they being threatened by someone? Whatever the case, this gives you somewhere to search or someone to talk to. And in this case, it gives them both.
And so with that, on November 3rd, 2016, a group of detectives go to Culhepps' residence to question him about Kayla and Charlie and this job they were there to do for him. Culhepps is very guarded in his answers. And that's fine because another group, a much larger group of detectives and officers, is already at his 95-acre property to search for more clues and to search for Kayla and Charlie.
You have 5 new messages. Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
The officers speaking to Culhepps tell him that both Kayla and Charlie's phones last pinged at his 95-acre property before they were each powered off. And strangely, Culhepps responds with, "Are you trying to find the girl?" To which the detective replies, "We're trying to find both of them." Are you fucking kidding me? That'll make the hair on the back of your neck stand up. Are you looking for the girl? Well, this guy's guilty, and it sounds like he's killed Charlie.
At this point, the detectives tell Culhepps they have a search warrant for his actual residence, authorizing them to search for his cell phone and to seize it once it's found. So, Todd, McComas, they have a search warrant for the 95-acre property to search for Kayla and Charlie. So, why does the search warrant for his residence only authorize police to search for and seize his cell phone?
Well, at this point, they only know Kayla and Charlie are missing. There's no evidence of a crime yet, and their phones last pinged at his 95-acre property, which is 8 miles away from his residence. So the warrant there authorizes them to search for Kayla and Charlie. And probably the phones too, if I had to guess. I'm assuming they didn't have any historical location information yet for Culhepps' phone because the only communication they have in their hands right now is between Kayla and Charlie about something that she had previously discussed with Culhepps that should have led them to the 95-acre property to begin with. So the police do have enough probable cause to search his home for his cell phone because it would likely contain communications with Kayla about that job. Now, there's other objectives in mind, too. So once they seize his phone, which they're authorized to do, for good reason, they will have his number and all the unique identifiers they need to request historical location data for that device to see where he was during this time that Kayla and Charlie's phones get powered off on his 95-acre property. And before I get too much further into the weeds on this phone stuff, we want to take you guys back to Cy Ray. Because Cy plays a major role in not only how the police get to this point, but even more importantly, in what happens next.
Luckily, they had the type of records that we could get pretty precise. You know, sometimes it's, hey, she's somewhere within this 10-mile radius. Good luck. With this one, though, it was really unique because you can see the roads. And I love cases that go out in the middle of the country. People think they're just screwing with law enforcement by driving out in the middle of nowhere to hide evidence or a body, but it's the best possible scenario because there's limited routes. So in the city, you know, you drive across the city, I can't tell what road you're on per se, but you drive out in the middle of nowhere, I can see exactly the road you're on because there's only one or two that allow you to do that. And then as soon as you take that next left turn, I can definitely pinpoint, okay, he or she is traveling on this road. And that's what really caught my attention is the road that led out to Culhepps' property was pretty remote. And then when you got on his property is pretty big. And there's a long driveway that actually goes back to where this little barn area was. And there was enough information in the records that I could tell the phone was in that area of the Culhepps farm. but most likely it probably deviated down that long driveway. So it was a grand slam at that part. Like, hey, here's where you go. And, you know, these cases, I've got my Google Earth set up is where I look at a lot of this information. And as I'm reviewing these cases, I'll drop a pin. And I usually will drop a pin on the map and I'll just type search here. And then I'll email that pin to the detectives. And I think that was actually a piece of evidence in this case is my email where I sent it back to Anderson PD. And I'm like, hey, you should search here. And I dropped the pin. So Anderson PD at that point runs over and talks to Spartanburg Sheriff's Department. And basically they're trying to brief them that, hey, we got this guy in Arizona who said you guys should search here. And Spartanburg doesn't know me from anybody. So they're like, well, we'll look into this ourselves. And there was enough information that piqued their interest. So they flew a helicopter over the property. That pin was probably maybe 50 yards from the Connex container.
Police at the other property first arrive at the garage. And as they enter, they spot a chain secured to an eye bolt into the wall next to the mattress on the floor. They also find reddish colored hair clippings in the bathroom trash.
When Cy leads officers to the area he had narrowed down on the property, 64 days after Kayla went missing, they see a Connex shipping container. They hear a woman screaming and banging on the walls inside, but there are 5 padlocks securing the door from the outside, so officers have to go get a cutting tool to cut the locks off before they can free her.
This must have seemed like an eternity for everyone involved, but especially Kayla. She's chained, sitting on a dog bed, preventing her from even being able to lay down. And as officers make entry and cut her free, they ask if she knows where Charlie is. And Kayla tells them he shot him.
An officer asks who shot him. And Kayla's strength and ability to stay calm for her next response amazes everyone at the scene. She says, and this is verbatim, Todd Culp shot Charlie Carver 3 times in the chest, wrapped him in a blue tarp, put him in the bucket of a tractor, locked me down here, and I never saw him again. She also tells the officers, quote, he says he's dead and buried. He says there's several bodies dead and buried out here. And he says the dogs will be ruined if they go looking because there's red pepper sprinkled throughout the place. End quote. It's as if she's been rehearsing this moment her entire captivity in order to keep herself sane. And as you might guess, the officers at that scene immediately let detectives at Culp's house know what they have found.
Detectives confront Culp about it, but he acts like he has no idea what they're talking about. And eventually, he utters those 6 little words all detectives hate to hear. I'm going to need an attorney.
Ugh.
They arrest Culp for kidnapping and transport him back to the station.
I'm going to need an attorney. First of all, yes, you do. Secondly, fuck you. You left a living witness, you dumb, sick, twisted freak. So yes, you're going to need an attorney because you're done.
Detectives later find Charlie's car hidden on the property. Culp had spray painted it a different color, removed the license plate, and covered it with limbs to conceal it from an aerial view.
Kayla's statement to police provides an even more twisted account of what happened. She says Culp told her at some point Stockholm Syndrome would kick in and eventually she would be happy to be with him, and that he planned to build her a soundproof room so she could live on the property long term. He also told her that he was a, quote, serial killer and a mass murderer. His words, not ours.
He also told her that his goal was to get his body count into the 3 digits, and that so far, he was only in the high 2 digits. He also told her he was going to teach her how to kill, and that she would become his partner. He said he used to kill people for the government, and that he was a paramilitary contractor.
Obviously, that last part is horseshit, but the rest would soon seem very, very likely. And eventually, police and Culp's attorney strike a deal. He would confess to Charlie's murder, Kayla's kidnapping and sexual assault, and he would clear up and confess to all other crimes he has committed, and in exchange, the state would not pursue the death penalty.
Culp took police to the location on the 95-acre property where Charlie's body was buried, and to another spot on the same property where two more bodies were buried. The bodies of Johnny Joe Coxie and his wife, Megan, a young couple who had been missing since December 2015. Autopsy would reveal Megan died from a gunshot wound to the head, while Johnny Joe died from gunshot wounds to his torso.
They were also able to determine that Johnny Joe died instantly from his wounds, while Megan was kept alive for 6 days before being shot in the head. That means Megan went through exactly what Kayla did.
Johnny Joe and Megan had both just been released from jail prior to going missing. They had a history of panhandling for money, and their baby had been taken away right after birth because it tested positive for heroin. So their lives weren't going all that well when they happened to cross paths with Todd Kolop.
Kolop said he picked the couple up at an intersection and offered them a job in the same manner he offered Kayla and Charlie a job. But he said once they got to the property, Johnny Joe tried to rob him at knife point. So Kolop said he shot Johnny Joe twice in the chest and then once in the back. And he told police he didn't really know what to do with Megan after that. He said one side of him wanted to, quote, drop her, but that the other side of him really wanted to, and I quote, save her ass. He said he was panicked, so he told her to sit down on the ground, which she did. He said he told her that he wasn't going to hurt her, but he handcuffed her and he patted her down. He said he didn't really know what to do with her at this point because he didn't want her to go to the cops, and he said he didn't feel like he could call the cops because even though he believed killing Johnny Joe was justified, he had a bunch of illegal firearms on his property.
Kolop said at that point, he just left Megan handcuffed on the ground while he scooped up Johnny Joe's body with his tractor and buried it. He said he tied Megan up and got her some food. Kolop said Megan wouldn't mellow out like Kayla did, but he did keep her for 6 days. After that, he said, and I quote, she went batshit crazy and tried to burn down my shipping container.
I'm going to call bullshit on he immediately went and got her something to eat. That part's made up. But what comes next is morbid. He told police that if they found a metal collar with little hooks on it that would dig into the neck if the person wearing it resisted, that it was Kayla's. He said she had actually asked him to buy that for her while she was being held captive by him. He also claimed Kayla wrote him letters in captivity asking him to have intercourse with her.
Ugh, this guy, I have no words.
Yeah, he's pretty much the worst monster imaginable. And obviously full of shit. He did to Johnny Joe and Megan exactly what he did to Charlie and Kayla. And in doing so, he was fulfilling a sick fantasy that obviously played out much differently in his own head than it actually occurred in real life.
Yeah, it's like he twisted things in his own head just so he wouldn't have to feel like he was a rapist and a murderer. That's exactly what he was. Despite what he finally admitted to, which was having what he described as consensual sex over several days with Megan, and then shooting her in the back of the head after she tried to set the shipping container on fire.
Worst monster imaginable. And as for what happened to Kayla and the duration for which it happened to her, there's a lesson to be learned for law enforcement. A lesson best explained by Cy Ray.
So, you know, that was the reality of when they found Kayla. And I'm looking at these phone records and I realize the day that she got to Kolop's property and the day that I'm getting this phone call that they rescued Kayla. And I'm doing my math, 64 days. And this whole time she's sitting out there literally as this dude's sex slave because we're waiting for that search warrant process, right? You've got to write the search warrant. You got to get the judge sign it. Now you got to send it off to the phone company. The phone company can take 4 to 6 weeks just to produce the records. Where if they would have ran under exigency and basically say, hey, this is life or death. We feel that Kayla could be in jeopardy. You could have had those records in a couple hours. This concept that law enforcement can't do anything until like, oh, we know that whatever, it is total bullshit. We look for missing and endangered people all the time. You don't have to have a crime for that nonsense. Okay, the next time you're sitting there thinking, can you articulate exigency over a search warrant process? Remember this. Like this girl sat in this container, or at least was dealing with this guy for 64 days because basically our inability as law enforcement to articulate, hey, this she could be in trouble. I try to express this to cops all the time now. From the moment I got the records until the moment I dropped a pin on Kolop's property was probably 10 minutes, maybe. Like it's that obvious when you know what you're looking for that you can look at this and be like, okay, well, the phone stopped working on this day at this property. You guys should probably go check this out. And in hindsight, you know, there's really no reason we couldn't have had that location September 1st. Like it's the records were already what they were. And if you think about law enforcement getting out there September 1st or even September 2nd, like what is that ripple effect of Kayla's life today compared to 60, you know, 62 days later, 64 days later? Man, I think the takeaway there is that ego, right? The law enforcement ego, ask for help. There's people who do this shit every day for free. I still consult on these cases for free. I don't think I've ever charged a police department for calling me ever. Like, pick up the phone and call. There's people just like me all over the place that would be more than happy to throw their hat in on shit like this.
Now, we take absolutely no joy in having the Monday morning detective game time detectives. But if what Cy just explained helps in just one person's case, worth it. So at this point, you might be asking why Todd Culp is known as the Amazon review killer. Well, turns out he purchased many of the necessary tools for these horrific crimes on Amazon, and he got some kind of sick-ass thrill over writing reviews for these items after he used them. And in the reviews, he described exactly what he was using them for.
Ugh. I mean, how brazen and stupid and twisted is that?
The most brazen and the most stupid and the most twisted. And here's what's weird about this whole thing. There is a type of comedy art form, if you will, where people do write funny reviews on Amazon or Yelp or places like this, and then folks will share them when they read them, and sometimes they go viral, especially if they're a little dark. So I'm sure that no one who read these reviews took them too seriously, but knowing what we know about Todd Culp now, this was ghoulishly sinister. One review for a high-security master padlock read, quote, "Solid locks. Have five on a shipping container. Won't stop them, but sure will slow them down till they're too old to care. 5 stars. Another for a fixed-blade SOG Pentagon knife read, "Haven't stabbed anyone yet, ... but I am keeping the dream alive, and when I do, it will be with a quality tool like this. 4 stars. Here's one for a shackle padlock. Works great, ... Also, if someone talks back, ... go old school on them by putting this in a sock and beating them. They will not appreciate the hardened steel like you will. 5 stars. You get it. They get worse and worse as it goes on.
I think by these reviews, it's painfully clear the frequency of his attacks were only going to increase if the police hadn't caught him when they did.
Oh, without a doubt. And as you're going to find out, his boasting, his bragging publicly about what he does is part of the evil within his persona. Remember the quadruple homicide at Superbike Motorsports that happened on the same day Culp quit his job at the poncho factory?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he confessed to it. A quadruple homicide that had police and residents baffled for 13 years. The murder of the motorcycle shop's owner, his mother, and 2 young employees right inside the store. All of them were found dead from gunshot wounds. Well, Culp said he bought a motorcycle there at the shop, but he had trouble riding it because it was too big for him. So he said he took the bike back to Superbike Motorsports to return it, and he said the staff that day was rude to him. He claimed they belittled him for his lack of riding experience and not being able to handle this bigger motorcycle, and ultimately, they refused to take the bike back.
Is anyone else surprised that he can't handle a large motorcycle?
I love that he can't handle a large motorcycle.
Culp tells police he leaves with the bike, and 14 days later, the bike gets stolen. So basically, he tells the police that he thinks it's the staff at Superbike Motorsports that had something to do with this. Because he said they knew where he had stored his bike. He said he then went back to the store at some point to look at more bikes after his bike got stolen. And the store manager told him that his bike that had been stolen was on its way back to Florida, as if he was admitting responsibility for the theft of his bike. And he said all the other employees just smirked and laughed about it. So he left.
Yep, just left. Walked right out of the motorcycle shop and drove straight to a gun shop, where he bought a Beretta 92FS semi-automatic handgun and 3 10-round magazines. And then he drove back to Superbike Motorsports and waited for all the paying customers to leave the store. Colette told police that he didn't want any, quote, collateral damage. He didn't want any innocent people getting hurt. So as soon as the store was emptied of customers, he asked to buy a bike so the mechanic would have to go to the back of the store to prep it. He then said braggingly, and I quote, "I cleared that building in under 30 seconds. He then looked at the detectives and said, quote, "I'm sorry, but you guys would have been proud." Then he chuckled.
As Kolob continued bragging and laughing about how well he had executed these murders, he said he started with the mechanic who was prepping the bike in the back. He said he walked up to him, shot him twice as he was crouched down cleaning the bike. Then the manager, owner, and the owner's son came rushing to the back of the store to see what was happening. He said he shot the mom first because she was closest, striking her three times in the chest. He described these three shots as, and I quote, "not my best work. The pattern was horrible." He then said the owner and manager ran for the door, so he fired a few shots, and one of the two, he can't remember which one, but one of the two went down. He said he then reloaded and shot the other man as he was exiting through the front door, so he actually ended up falling outside. Kolob chuckled as he recounted this part of the story and said, "that was a fast reload."
These are all actual quotes taken from his statements to police. It's incredible. The gall of this guy, the lack of humanity, the pride he took in what he had done, and the skill in which he had done it. He actually thought these police officers would be impressed as he described these murders. He has no concept of how a normal person, someone who's not an evil piece of shit, would view what he's saying. I mean, the fact that he could just sit there with no emotion, that very first judge was right. There was no fixing that 15-year-old kid because he was already a monster. And what really weirds me out about this guy is he is very, very much aware of what he is.
Very much so. And he did have emotion. He was proud of himself. He was laughing. He just didn't have normal reaction and emotion. The first indication that we have of it is when he told Kayla that he was both a serial killer and a mass murderer. Like, he may not have a concept of how we view the evil aspect of who and what he is, but he understands who and what he is by definition.
Yeah, and it's so intriguing to me. When he finishes his statement to police about the four murders at Superbike Motors, he tells police that the staff there had given him a t-shirt with the store logo on it. And he tells them he still has that t-shirt, and he says, quote, "which is weird because I'm not a trophy guy. I don't keep trophies," end quote. Like, he not only wants police to know he clearly knows what he is, which is a serial killer, but also by stating that he doesn't keep trophies, I think he's conveying to them something like, hey, you guys don't know as much about us, serial killers, as you think you do. Like, don't put me in your small little box, man. And I don't think you can put him in a box. Not that each serial killer isn't different from one another. They're all different. But this guy was absolutely clear and absolutely accurate about who and what he is. Just like he said, he's a serial killer and a mass murderer. And as far as I know, that makes him very unique and very scary.
And he probably would appreciate you thinking how unique he is, by the way.
Without a doubt.
He has this twisted, sexual, torture-ridden fantasy that he's always trying to satisfy with this gratification of killing the boyfriend or husband in front of the girlfriend or wife and believing he could eventually turn her into a murder slave or whatever. But then, in addition to that, he has the capacity for random acts of mass murder. No one is safe with this guy. No one.
What freaks me out the most, it's almost like he feels he's a different species than the rest of us. A superior species to our species. Like, he's the only human walking the planet and the rest of us are just varmint. And if he wants to capture one of us and keep us in a cage for his own amusement, then what's the big deal? We're varmint. Or if we annoy him in some way, then he doesn't put any more thought into killing a roomful of us than he would a few raccoons that were getting to his trash cans at night. I really think that's how he feels about every other human on the planet. like we're raccoons or squirrels or lightning bugs or whatever. And I don't know how any human gets to that point. And I guess that's probably the fascination we all have with evil fucks like this.
Well, he's definitely a different species. He's a special kind of monster. And he managed to avoid the death penalty somehow. So he's still alive and kicking in a prison. And probably still laughing. But clearing the unsolved cases, recovering the bodies of the other victims, and getting them home to their families is more important than anything else about this monster or where he's at or what he's doing. But suffice it to say, death penalty or not, he's rotting behind bars right where he belongs until, you know, he's knocking on hell's door.
Yeah, I don't think anyone enjoys having to make those kinds of deals, but unfortunately, they're necessary. So in summary, Todd Culhep is an evil, sadistic piece of shit. And if you'd personally like to let him know what an evil, sadistic piece of shit you think he is, you can do so by writing him a letter. And after you've written that letter, you'll need to put it in an envelope and address it to write this down.
And get your notebook ready.
Yeah, write it in your notebook. What are you doing? You should all have notebooks by now. Write this down. Todd C. Culhep, Kohlhepp, ID number 003-72454. Lieber, Lieber, Correctional Institution, P.O. Box 205, Ridgeville, South Carolina, 29472. So when you get a chance, write him a letter and let him know he's not superior. And that, in fact, he's lower than the heaviest piece of whale shit in the deepest part of the ocean.
And while you're in the writing mood, if you like this show, write us a review.
And make sure you check out our sister podcast, Socialite Crime Club, hosted by our very own Cy Ray, who helped save Kayla Brown and bring Todd Culhep's reign of terror to an end. And his extremely talented wife, Carrie, who brings a great deal of law enforcement knowledge to the show as well. Socialite Crime Club, it launches Wednesday, November 1st, so be ready.
Until next week, take care and take care of each other.
And if you're one of those industry professionals who works in crime and enjoys being publicly dismissive of true crime podcasts and true crime podcasters in general, please keep this in mind. A member of our team actually helped catch the Amazon review killer. So mute yourself. Because we're the investigators!
I came from the mud. There's dirt on my hands. Strong like a tree. There's roots where I stand. Oh, I've been running from the law. Hope they won't shoot me down soon. Catch me howling at the moon.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.